good evening. Attorney General Barr says no evidence of election fraud. World AIDS Day is commemorated, as is the day Palestinians lost their nation 73 years ago. Some schools in New York will reopen next week, but Catholic schools are left out. With these and other stories, I'm Paul D'Arienzo with the news for Tuesday, December 1st, 2020. On Tuesday, Iran's parliament approved a bill suspending United Nations inspections of its nuclear facilities and requiring a boost in uranium enrichment. The bill gives European countries 1 month to ease sanctions on Iran's key oil and gas sector and to restore its access to the international banking system. Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei has the final say on all nuclear policies, and the vote was seen as an act of defiance after the killing of a prominent Iranian nuclear scientist last month. And Elton John's AIDS Foundation and TikTok have teamed up for a campaign based around World AIDS Day, aiming to educate millions on the TikTok platform about the disease. Beginning at 2 p.m. today, the singers hosted a live event featuring TikTok stars, celebrity guests, and performances. Sir Elton has joined leading British HIV/AIDS charities in calling for wider HIV testing to halt new transmissions in England. More than 38 million people worldwide are currently infected with HIV, and the AIDS pandemic has killed about 33 million people since it began in the 1980s. The World Health Organization's Dr. Tedros Adhanom is also calling for world solidarity to get back on track to end HIV.
A record 26 million people are now on life-saving antiretroviral therapy. But that leaves 12 million people who are living with HIV but not receiving treatment. And an estimated 7 million people who have not been diagnosed. We're also investigating whether COVID-19 presents an additional threat to people living with HIV, making it even more urgent that people with HIV have access to treatment. And while millions of people now have access to ARVs, global targets for prevention, testing, and treatment are off target. Progress is stalling because HIV prevention and testing services are not reaching the groups that need them most. Addressing all these challenges will require a people-centered approach with comprehensive and integrated health services that address the needs of the whole person. That's why WHO's top priority is universal health coverage based on strong primary health care with an emphasis on promoting health and preventing disease. Ultimately, our fight is not against a single disease. Our fight is against a world in which people get sick and die simply because they are poor, or female, or young, gay, transgender, sex workers, use drugs, or are in prison. Our fight is for health for all. Working together in solidarity, we can get back on track to ending the AIDS epidemic and build a healthier, safer world for all of us.
Dr. Tedros Adhanom is director of the World Health Organization. He says COVID-19 is having a pronounced effect on people living with HIV, adding there is evidence HIV makes COVID worse. Locally, the New York City Department of Health has conducted a large-scale study of New Yorkers showing the two main drivers of coronavirus infections as household contact and gatherings of 10 or more people. The commissioner of the New York City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene is Dr. Dave Chokshi. He's asking people with conditions making them more susceptible to COVID-19 to stay at home. Dr. Chokshi also made the connection to the city's long battle with HIV/AIDS.
That's why today I'm issuing a commissioner's notice that warns at-risk New Yorkers about the growth in COVID and that urges appropriate precautions. That means stopping non-essential activities, staying in as much as possible, and avoiding social activities outside of your household. We'll be working with partner agencies, with community-based organizations, doctors, and others to distribute this notice. But there's one thing that I want to say to all New Yorkers. A risk factor does not alone determine risk. Whether or not you are a senior or have one of these conditions, COVID-19 can infect you. It can cause serious illness. And sometimes long-term symptoms. and could spread from you to others who are at even greater risk. To invoke the great Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., we are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. And with that same historic lens, today does make me take stock of another mystery virus, which a generation ago was fast spreading and about which our understanding changed by the day, HIV/AIDS. At that time, too, there were people who stepped up and changed the world. And so on World AIDS Day, I'd like to recognize what those heroes achieved in our ongoing fight against HIV. We are close to ending the HIV/AIDS epidemic. We must learn from that experience as we continue to hone our response to COVID-19.
Dr. Dave Chokshi is commissioner of the New York City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene. A former member of the AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power, ACT UP, is James Krellenstein. He's founder of the group Prep for All that challenges pharmaceutical company monopolies on life-saving drugs. Krellenstein says there are similarities in the response to COVID and AIDS in the rejection of science.
COVID-19 shows in some ways how little we learn from the HIV epidemic in the United States. The fact is that I think all of us can safely conclude that our public health system was not prepared for another pandemic. And I think a lot of the same institutional failures, while I think probably different, maybe in nature, you know, there wasn't the same homophobia necessarily playing a role or transphobia, but the actual incompetence of our public health system in perpetuating the COVID-19 epidemic really harkened back to the early days of the HIV epidemic. The antipathy that we have towards science is a much broader problem than what we're experiencing just in COVID-19 or just HIV. I think it has a lot to do with what role science plays in our society. We saw it in the right underestimating the ability of climate change, of the consequences of climate change. And all of this has led to this sort of choose your own reality world, exemplified by Donald Trump. People didn't want to shut down. They didn't want to have to wear masks. And Trump, rather than forcing people to admit that reality existed, he said, no, it's just all fake. It's all phony. And that is a very deep pathology in our culture. We saw something similar to it in the HIV crisis with people like Duisberg, the famous UC Berkeley retrovirologist who argued that AIDS is not caused by HIV. And then we had the government of South Africa take that position and literally kill hundreds of thousands of people. When you have societies that don't trust science and then their governments act in unscientific fashions. We learned from HIV and we learned again in COVID. A lot of people die.
James Krellenstein, he's a founder of the AIDS activist group Prep for All. Speaking at the Apollo Theater, Governor Andrew Cuomo announced that based on the most recent data, New York State has bent the curve on the HIV epidemic. The data, he says, shows in 2019 there were 1,700 new cases of HIV transmission, the lowest since the epidemic began. He said New York was ahead of the federal government in recognizing that AIDS was more than just a health problem.
It was not really a medical crisis. It was worse. It was a social crisis. HIV/AIDS became a lightning rod for stereotyping and for discrimination. It was used to fan the flames of fear and bigotry. It was a looking glass into the soul of society. And individual and collective reactions spoke volumes. Some buildings closed their doors. Some families cast aside loved ones. President Reagan refused to acknowledge the disease for 3 years of his presidency. But then there were those who rose to the occasion, who opened their hearts and opened their minds and reached out to people like the people who are in this room today. We had government leaders who led with the voice of our better angels. I'm very proud to say that the first state and the first governor that responded to the AIDS crisis with a real action plan was the state of New York and Governor Mario Cuomo. We have made remarkable progress. You put education together with medical advancement, together with political activism, and that has been the real cocktail of success. This year is the first year that there have been no mother-to-newborn transmissions. Isn't that amazing? But we are not home yet. The goal is to end the epidemic, and that's why New York was the first state to give it a date, a target date, 2020, as the date to end the AIDS epidemic, end it once and for all. That's success.
Governor Andrew Cuomo. In recognition of World AIDS Day, Governor Cuomo has also directed state landmarks to be lit red throughout the evening. And you're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. The United Nations is marking the International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people. It was November 29th, 1947. The UN announced the partition of Palestine into two states, Israel and the territories now governed by separate authorities on the West Bank and Gaza. The partition led to mass outpourings of public anger in Egypt and other neighboring countries. The next year, Israeli militias and terrorist groups had effectively made 750,000 people into refugees. More than 400 Palestinian villages were sacked, and most refugees fled to camps along Israel's new borders. The United Nations Secretary General is Antonio Guterres.
On the ground, the expansion of settlement planning and construction continues, while demolitions and seizures of Palestinian-owned structures by Israeli authorities across the occupied West Bank, including East Jerusalem, reached the highest documented rate in 4 years. Such actions are contrary to international law and undermine the prospects for the establishment of a viable, contiguous Palestinian state. Acts of violence, the constant threat of escalation in Gaza, movement and access restrictions, incitement and human rights violations persist, keeping the situation highly volatile. In Gaza, militants continue to fire indiscriminate rockets and mortars towards Israeli civilian population areas in violation of international humanitarian law, which heightens the risk of a new round of hostilities. Gaza entered the 13th year of Hamas control. On the other hand, tight closures have exacerbated the suffering of the people. The lifting of the closures in line with Security Council Resolution 1860 and the reunification of Gaza and the occupied West Bank under a single democratic national government are essential for addressing the needs of the population and restoring faith in a political horizon. I hope that recent developments will encourage Palestinian and Israeli leaders to re-engage in meaningful negotiations with the support of the international community towards a two-state solution and will create opportunities for regional cooperation. Only a two-state solution that realizes the legitimate national aspirations of Palestinians and Israelis can lead to sustainable peace. The United Nations remains committed to supporting Palestinians and Israelis to resolve the conflict. The framework capable of realizing the legitimate aspirations of those peoples is one of two states living side by side in peace and security, based on the 1967 borders and with Jerusalem as the capital of both states. On this International Day of Solidarity, let us renew our commitment to the Palestinian people in their quest to achieve their inalienable rights and build a future of peace, justice, security, and dignity.
Antonio Guterres is the Secretary General of the United Nations. A fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and a WBAI programmer, Phyllis Bennis, says today is a commemoration of a terrible injustice, the loss of the Palestinian nation, and birth of an apartheid state similar to white-ruled South Africa.
That day was declared 30 years to the day after the UN itself passed Resolution 181 that was known as the Partition Resolution that first divided historic Palestine and set the stage for the war of 1947-48, what Palestinians call the Nakba, or the catastrophe, what Israelis call their war of independence. And that war led to the expulsion of three-quarters of the indigenous population of Palestine. 750,000 Palestinians were forcibly expelled from their homes, and most of them from the country. They have never been allowed to return, even to visit, let alone to return to their homes. And what we know now is that Nakba, that catastrophe, has continued for what is now 73 years. There were threats earlier this year about annexation. That failed, formal annexation failed, but de facto annexation continues.
What does annexation mean? I'm sorry. I've heard that word so many times, I'm not even sure what it means.
Annexation in this context means Israeli control that would be legalized under Israeli law, that it would make the territories subject to Israeli law, rather than the current situation where occupied territory is governed by a separate law, military law. This would make parts of the occupied territory, specifically the settlements and all the land that the settlers want to claim, which is about 60% of the West Bank, it would make all of that essentially part of Israel. It's what they tried to do to the Golan Heights back in 1981, to annex the Golan Heights, meaning to make it part of Israel. No other country has acknowledged that until this year, when the U.S. acknowledged that the what they call the extension of Israeli law. That's the term, that the term of art, if you will, that's used instead of the term formal annexation, that would be acceptable to the U.S. and they would recognize it. Trump also recognized Israel's occupation of the Golan Heights as now being the Golan Heights being subject to Israeli law and essentially part of Israel. The failure to fully annex the West Bank land did not take into account the fact that de facto annexation has been underway for decades. And what that means is that the people who live, Palestinians who live in the occupied West Bank, live under Israeli control. The difference is that they live under an apartheid regime where there are two different legal systems, one for Palestinians and one for Israelis, in the same territory, meaning within the occupied West Bank. And occupied Jerusalem is a different set. Gaza is also treated separately. So that's the definition of apartheid, when you have two or more legal systems for two or more sets of people in one area of land ruled by one authority, in this case the government of Israel, and those people are ruled by different legal systems based on race or language or religion or ethnicity or national origin. Those are all components of the definition of apartheid. So that's what we're looking at, and that's why people say that the Nakba did not end in 1948. The Nakba continues. There is a virtually global recognition that East Jerusalem is occupied territory, but the United States, under Donald Trump, moved its embassy to Jerusalem, and there was no international consequence. The Israeli military uses, even documented by the U.S. State Department every year, uses military force as well as its national police to continuously suppress Palestinian rights. And yet, the U.S. still pays $3.8 billion a year of our tax money directly to the Israeli military. These are all components of how the Nakba continues, and it makes the U.S. complicit.
Phyllis Bennis is a fellow with the Institute for Policy Studies. In related news, in the past 24 hours, Palestinians have seen the highest daily rate of infections since the beginning of the coronavirus pandemic. The Palestinian Ministry of Health reports 2,536 new cases of the virus in the past 24 hours and a record 16 deaths, raising the death rate to 838 people. Meanwhile, the leader of Hamas in the Gaza Strip, Yahya Sinwar, has tested positive for COVID-19 and is now in quarantine. Last month, veteran Palestinian negotiator Saeb Erekat, chief architect of decades of negotiations with Israel, died from the coronavirus. And closer to home, Attorney General William Barr said today the Justice Department has not uncovered evidence of widespread voter fraud that would change the outcome of the 2020 presidential election. Trump responded by tweeting more baseless claims of fraud. His attorney, Rudy Giuliani, issued a scathing statement accusing Barr of investigating nothing. Meanwhile, the New York Times reports today Giuliani talked to Trump about getting a preemptive pardon before Trump leaves office. Giuliani is the focus of a criminal investigation by the Manhattan U.S. Attorney's Office over charges he violated foreign lobbying laws in Ukraine. Investigators are also looking into the former mayor's role in the firing of the ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch. U.S. intelligence agencies cautioned President Trump Russian operatives were using Giuliani to funnel disinformation to the White House. Giuliani has been appearing at various events in swing states trying to overturn the results of last month's election. As of Monday, all six battleground states, Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Arizona, Nevada, and Georgia, certified their election results, cementing Biden's victory. In more campaign news, Giuliani's Ukrainian-born associate, Lev Parnas, pleaded not guilty in a Manhattan federal court on charges he swindled investors in an insurance company in Florida. The same company paid Giuliani $500,000 for consulting work before he linked up with Parnas in an unsuccessful fishing expedition to turn up dirt on Joe Biden and his son Hunter. And in a last-ditch effort to turn back yesterday's certification of Wisconsin as a win for Biden, the Trump campaign has sued the state, seeking to disqualify more than 221,000 ballots in the state's two most Democratic counties. The state's highest court, controlled 4-3 by conservatives, is also considering two other lawsuits filed by conservatives trying to invalidate ballots cast during the presidential election. Trump is not challenging any ballots cast in conservative counties he won. And Americans returning from Thanksgiving break face strict new coronavirus measures around the country as holiday gatherings over the long weekend have health officials bracing for the worst. Almost 1.2 million people passed through U.S. airports Sunday, the most since the pandemic gripped the country in March. Today is also the day the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention decides who gets the vaccine first. It'll probably be healthcare personnel, essential workers, people at risk, and people over 65 years of age. Moderna Incorporated says it'll ask regulators to allow emergency use of its COVID-19 vaccine, while Pfizer is also seeking approval for its vaccine and hopes to begin administering shots in December. But even as New York is sending some folks indoors, the Board of Education is letting a few back. On December 7th, public elementary schools are reopening. New York City is the first in the nation to open its schools. It's an experiment and a model for other school districts across the country. Somos Community Care works with officials to help protect New York City schools from COVID-19. It's a network of over 3,500 medical providers serving 800,000 patients. Its chair is Dr. Ramon Talaj. He spoke with WBAI earlier today.
Had a positive test, which is, you should know, was very low. It sometimes was less than 1%. If we have somebody positive, within 2 hours, we have to find that person between us or the state or the Department of Health or H&H to be sure that the person doesn't show up next day. And the state probably and the city and the Department of Health will jump on the patient to take a look what kind of contact, who, how, and that helped a lot. In our case, it was always very low. Sometimes we have probably, I don't know how many tests right now, but at some point it was 20,000 tests done, and at that point it was like a 40-something test positive, which is very low, less than 0.5.
What's it going to look like for kids going back to school?
What I'm seeing, that's me personally, I've seen they're trying to do is that it's a balance here. If you have parents who are not working now, they're in the house, especially young kids, who don't mingle so much, jumping around. They follow more rules, and the parents could go back to work, and those kids will get the food and the school. If we follow the same protocol, nothing is guaranteed. I was one of the ones who say, I don't want to open the school. But the result that I got with this type of testing that we did when the mayor decided is very low, the result of positive test. My expectation is it is still the same. It will happen the same. It will continue that way. If not, I guess the mayor will make a high decision every time it's needed. We have to see.
What is it about the virus that we've learned?
People need to know, not treatment has been changed. Yes, we know a little bit more. This pneumonia, what is happening in the lungs, is more what kind of type of inflammatory affection of the vessels, and the hypoxemia is not only referred because of the lung problem, it's more because of what happened with the clotting everywhere, and you get more medication for that, some more anti-inflammatory, there's new medication, but still no clear cure for that, and still no vaccine. I mean, this virus still is a killer. And you could see that around the country. When somebody tells you 2,800 people die in one day, it's like those buildings fell in New York every day. One of them is falling down in the whole country as a country together. That's a lot of people dying from this virus, then what we learn from this virus is that we have to continue doing the mask. We must use the mask. Do it. And you wash your hands. Social distance is possible. Remember, in our buildings, in our community, 6 feet apart, somebody, those 10 people living in one-bedroom apartment, to be 6 feet apart, that would not happen. But in our community, around 35 to 40% of people were positive in the first wave. Therefore, when the virus comes back, it will affect us because still 55 to 60 haven't seen the virus. In other places, like we see now, around the state, will be more dangerous because the penetration, they were so low in the first time. This is why we're seeing some other places now getting higher numbers.
What do you think about the vaccine? Do you have hope for these vaccines?
I'm part of the commission that the governor decided to put together for the distribution. There's another group to decide which one is the best vaccine. I say this only. Every medication, everything has side effects. Even the aspirin could kill you, the Tylenol, if you use it inappropriately. When they decide which one, we have to look at all those results, what's been happening when they try and follow those patients. But through the humanity, vaccines are saving lives in the world. The polio vaccine, the measles vaccine, all of this vaccine has been proved. Well, we know this is different than the other ones, but we have to work. It's worse to have the disease. We have to put in a balance.
Is an RNA vaccine, a different type of vaccine?
I understand. I mean, they used to fight a war with a small cannon ball. Now they use atomic bombs. Improve every time. You have more risk? Of course you have more risk. You have more risk of the people working on that, using it. But we have to improve every time. That is why it was so different now. It was supposed to be millions of people die, like it happened 100 years ago. And it's still that happening this time, by far less, because the communication is better. All the things are better. Hopefully, the vaccine will be better in some direction to help people. Instead of having the disease and dying, or not knowing what's going to happen to them, it will be more control, because we know what kind of side effect the vaccine could produce and be on top of that.
Dr. Ron Talaj is chair of SOMOS. Not every school in New York is getting the benefit of intensive testing and tracing. Last week, a state Supreme Court judge found that the city is responsible for providing all 172 Catholic schools in the city with the testing kits already available at public schools. Mayor Bill de Blasio has decided to appeal the decision. He said, "We got a huge number of kids to serve. We need all the resources that we have right now," said de Blasio at a news conference today. And that's some of the news for Tuesday, December 1st, 2020. The news was produced with Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. From New York City for the WBAI News, I'm Paul DiRienzo. Thanks for listening. Have a safe and peaceful evening.